Okay, Erev Tov, we'll get started. I appreciate the fact that people came out on this rather inclement, nasty evening, but hopefully it'll make it worth your while. I hope. Firstly, just to make an announcement in terms of next week, because obviously next week's Purim. So we're not learning Monday night, although there is the lecture which is being announced over here on Sunday night, please God. Which I'm actually enjoying researching because it's bringing back a lot of memories. And the week after that, unfortunately, I also won't be here because it's my spring break from college. So spring break means you've got to go away. At least my wife thinks so. So Mitzvah Shem, the next year will be the 23rd, March 23rd. So we're in the Purim, the Purim to Pesach period. And so maybe we'll do maybe a bit of something on Pesach as well. Good evening, Erev Tov. So not Monday night, I'll be here to clap homon, but please God, hopefully, but not necessarily in a more than that. All right, we're in the middle of Perek Chav, chapter 20, and we are learning yet even more about David and about Yonatan. And as I said last week, I'm frustrated because I've got a whole sefer here, just on one chapter, this sefer Bachrach, which is just so beautiful. And again, I'll try and share some of the tamtzit, some of the essence of what he says. It's impossible to give you the full, what they call it, the full Monty, the full version of what he says. It's just too long, and it's too detailed to give over and to do it justice in a short time. But there is something that we're going to say, which I think is really very precious. He's very much into this idea, Maase Avot Siman Labanim. The idea is that what happens to the Avot, what happened to Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, and he sort of expands it. What happens to the Imahot? What happens to people like Rachel? What happens to Leah? Is also Siman Labanim, as a Siman for future generations. And we're going to come across a bit of that this evening. We spoke about that in one of the previous shiurim when we spoke about the visit that David made to the front line. Remember, he had this a guarantee which Yehuda had made, his great-great-great-great grandfather had made to Binyamin, to look after Binyamin. And David went in order to fulfill that by going to essentially look after Shaul. Okay, that was the whole thing that we learned about previously. Today we're going to have a similar but a kind of reverse situation. It's not going to be Yehuda looking after Binyamin, it's going to be Binyamin looking after Yehuda, but we'll come to that. I'll let you think about that for a few minutes and we'll come to it. Initially, let's just finish the chapter 20, Mocha Chodesh. We're into Rosh Chodesh at this point. And also, obviously this evening we have to also mention that it's a very, very important time to learn. It's the Yortzeit of Moshe Rabbeinu, it's Zayin Adar, which is always a special time. And for those who are into the Hasidic world, I think that's particularly relevant that there's a lot of stuff going on in terms of what this date represents, Zayin Adar. Also, of course, there are the Chevra Kadisha, which we have to make recognition of, traditionally has their dinner on Zayin Adar, and obviously this is something which we are very grateful for, Chesed Shel Emes, which goes on, thank God, in many communities and is so appreciated, and very special people that do that. The also, I just want to make mention as a dedication to somebody who unfortunately just passed away in our community, who I really had a very short but very, very pleasant connection with, somebody called Alan Wax that we spoke about before. Very, very special person. He was a Luntzman. He originated from Manchester, England. Came here with his family in 1938 as a young child. And had a lot of English connections there, including a lot of family, people that I knew. And I was just very sorry when he passed away. We just finished the shiva this morning. And Tehi Nafsho Tzura B'Tzura Chaim, may his soul be bound in the eternal bond of life, as they say. And Shama should have an aliyah. The perek that we're learning, we're right in the middle of chapter 20, and we're up to Pasuk Chaf Dalet. That is on page 96. And remember last week we had this incredible arrangement that David and Yonatan make between each other in order to deal with the situation. Is Shaul friend or foe? Is Shaul going to make peace with David, or is he in fact now going to show David once and for all that the connection between him and David is very, very distant, and David has to then run away? And remember, we spoke last week about the fact David ran away has become a metaphor for Galut. A lot of stuff going on over here, which has got wider ramifications. So look where we're up to here. Pasuk Chof Dala, chapter 20, verse 24. We'll just run through the psukim, and then hopefully we'll talk a bit about Shaul. This is really what I want to get to. If we have the opportunity, maybe we'll start it today, and we'll finish it next time. So Pasuk Chof Dala. David was hiding in the field. Okay, we know that he had to hide because he didn't go to the Suda. He wasn't sure what Shaul was going to do. Vayachodesh, so comes Rosh Chodesh. Vayeshev HaMelech al Alechem Lechol, and the king is making his Suda, and they're breaking bread together and they're eating. Vayeshev HaMelech al Moshavo, Kapam Bapam, and the king has a certain seat, obviously a throne or whatever it was. El Moshav HaKir, and was by the wall. Vayokom Yonatan, Vayeshev Avneh Mitzad Shaul, and Yonatan got up. Essentially moved away a bit because he wasn't quite sure how his father was going to react to the following conversation. Yonatan is going to try and find out what Shaul feels about David. So Avner sat down next to Shaul. Avner was the captain of the army. Vayipokei makom David, and David was not there. David was gone. Didn't turn up. And this was a 2-day Rosh Chodesh, and there was the first day. It didn't seem to bother Shaul. Vaylo diber Shaul mumabi amahu. Shaul said nothing on that day. Ki amar mikrehu bilti tahor hu ki lo tahor. Basically, he put it down to a situation that David wasn't tahor. He had to go to mikveh, and he basically had to come in a state of tahor. That in itself is an incredible thing. Now, the Gemara talks about the madrega of eating chulin atarat hakodesh. Right, you come across this in Mishnayot. The idea that they would be making themselves tahor just to eat regular food. This is not eating kosher, this is not kohenim. This is just regular food. But even in that situation, they wanted to be tahor. This shows, again, a religious side to people like Shaul that we tend to lose in the turmoil of what's going on. But it's just an interesting sort of thing to note. That he claims that because David wasn't tahor, wasn't spiritually purified in the necessary way, therefore he couldn't attend the meal. It's fascinating, this, yeah.
Apparently, very denigrating of David, because David, after all, is married to Michal.
Yeah.
And Mikrehu means it's an omission.
Yeah.
That is not through his wife.
Yeah. Yeah, he's putting down David the whole time. It's silly. And again, you know, you're right, and it's the whole thing over here is very tenuous. There's no question about it. There is a metach. There is a tension going on over here. You're absolutely right. And we'll go on. Vayhi mocharat achodesh hasheni. So the second day, vayipokim kom David, and again, David doesn't turn up. Place is empty. Vayomer shaul el Yonatan bano madua. And madua is always a very strong word. It's not just lama. Madua is like, you know, really emphasis. Madua lo bai ben Yishai. He doesn't call him David. He says, why doesn't the son of Yishai turn up? Gam tamol, gam ayom al alechem. He's not coming for the bread. Are we too, you know, you can always hear the conversation. What, we're too good for him? You know, that sort of intonation, if that's the way to express it. Vayan Yonatan at Shaul, so Yonatan answered. Nishon nishal David mei modiat beit lechem. David took his leave, he asked me, because he had to go to Beit Lechem. So he makes an excuse. At this point, look what he says. Vayomer shalcheinina. He tells his father the whole story, that he has to go, the story that they made up. Remember, it wasn't a real story. And this is back to what we learned right at the beginning of our series, in this, when we started learning here, the whole thing of a white lie as opposed to a black lie. This is not this is kind of using the situation, suggesting a circumstance which may not necessarily be true, but is diplomatic to get him out of a corner here. So what happened was that David had, and Yonatan had worked out this suggestion to say to the king that David had to go and do a sacrifice. And like we saw with Shmuel, the same thing at the time when he went to anoint David, and again, it's all to do with Shaul and saying to Shaul that he's doing one thing when in fact he means to do something else. It's very ironic that it's almost the same excuse being used for the same person, to the same person, but obviously by different people. That was Shmuel, this is David. But it's very ironic that there's a repeat of that. Vayomer Shalcheninu, Pasuk Kaf Tet, send me ki zevach mishpacha lanu be'er. We've got a family offering to fulfill or whatever. And my brother commanded me. In other words, basically what he's saying is, I suppose Achi here maybe is referring to presumably to David. He's calling him my brother. So David had said that his brother had invited him to come. David's brother had invited him to come to do this, and he wanted to see his brothers. So Yonatan says, that's why he hasn't come to the table of the king. Now at this point, the king is so negative towards David that he sees this as an act of rebellion. It's a pretty shocking thing. It doesn't turn up. You know, you forgot to go to the wedding. It's not a rebellion against the people who invited you. And in this case, the king was very sensitive. Vayicha'af Shaul b'Yonatan, and Shaul got angry with Yonatan. Not with David, but, you know, with his son. Vayomelo ben Navata Mardud, and he calls him a terrible thing. He says here, you are the son of a woman who is, how does he translate it here? You are a straying, son of a straying woman, deserving punishment. Mardut is almost lashon merit, of rebelliousness. Right? He basically accused him of something which was very bad. Halo yodati ki bocheh ata leben Yishai, I see that you've chosen Ben Yishai, levashtecha, for your shame, the boshes ervat imecha, and for the shame of the nakedness of your mother. Basically, the Mefarshim say, what does that mean? That means that he was basically saying to Yonatan that by showing your friendship with David, which Shaul is aware of, the reality is that it could very well be that people will start questioning whether Yonatan is really the son of Shaul. They'll say that maybe Yonatan was not the son of Shaul, because how can he be friendly with David and be the son of the king at the same time? And there's a whole doubt that may be brought up by this. And therefore, basically, by having this friendship, the king is saying that people will start questioning the yichus of Yonatan. So the king is very unhappy, as you can see. As long as Ben Yishai is alive, Allah Adama, on the land, lo tikon ata malchutecha, your kingship will never be established. You who are the successor to the throne, you'll never be able to do it because Ben Yishai is around. Biata shlach v'kachoto elai, bring him to me, ki ben moved, who he deserves to die. This is very strong. And Yonatan immediately stands up and says no. He says no to his father, and this is very difficult. Vayan Yonatan et Shaul avim, Yonatan answers to Shaul, Vayomer elav, lama yumat, why should he die? Me'asa, what has he done? Wow. It takes a lot of guts to do that. Stand up to the king. And the king is so enraged that basically he doesn't even speak. He's got this handy spear. The spear seems to be with him the whole time. Vayotel sholat chanita lav lakoto. He picks up the spear, almost looking, not that he's going to, but looking as if he's going to kill his son. Wow. Vayeda Yonatan, that point Yonatan knows, ki kalahi mim aviv, it's already decided, it's finished, as it were, in behalf of his father, lamita David, to kill David. He knows that that's it. He can't push, as you say nowadays, push the button anymore. He can't probe anymore. He knows that that's it. That is the relationship between his father and David, is one where his father has decided David is a rebel, he's a moreid b'malchut, and he deserves to die. We're going to have to deal with Shaul, as I said last week, and hopefully today we'll get to that in due course. Now listen to this. Vayokam Yonatan min ha-shulchan v'chariav. Yonatan was very angry. He also got up and he went off in a huff. V'lo achal b'yom ha-chodesh ha-sheni lechem, he didn't eat for that day. Ki netzav al David, he was so upset for David. He was so sad. Ki echlim aviv, because his father had fashemed him. He'd embarrassed. Even though he wasn't there, the way that he spoke about David was so embarrassing. Now they meet up again as they had agreed with the siman of the arrows, which was always going to be a sign from Hashem where the arrow goes. And of course, at this point, the arrow has to go beyond David as a sign that David has to run away. And he's with a young lad, and he's got a young lad with him who basically is carrying all his stuff. as they would do. Vayomer l'naro rutz mitzana, and of course he tells the lad to run. Mitzana tachitzim, find the arrows asher anochi moreh, which I'm going to shoot. And of course he makes sure that they go a distance. Hanar ratzuhu yara chetzi laviro, and he shot the arrow to go beyond him, and obviously meaning beyond David as well. Vayavo hanar makom achetzi, the lad runs in that direction. Asher yara Yonatan, to the arrow which Yonatan has shot. Vayikra Yonatan achrei hanar vayomer, halo achetzi mcha vahala. So Yonatan says to the lad, keep running. It's further. It's like, you know, you throw a bone to the dog. You know, go a bit further. And of course, while the lad is running, Yonatan and David have a final conversation at this point. It's so sad. Vayikra Yonatan achrei hanar mehera chush al tamar. Run, quickly, go. Vayilaket na Yonatan et achetzi vayivol adonam. He picked up the arrow, brought it back. Vanali odam umar. The lad didn't understand. Ach Yonatan v'David yodu et adavar. Yonatan and David understood the whole thing. Now this is where he sends the lad away. He gave him his vest, his kelim, whatever it was, his weapons, and go and take them back to the city. At that point, the lad leaves them alone, and this is where David and Yonatan say their farewells. Hanaba, the lad comes, for David comes etzel hanegev. David gets up from this place towards the south. Falls down on his face. Bows three times. They kiss each other. They cry one upon the other. Ah, David Higdil. And David did more than Yonatan. He cried even harder than Yonatan. And of course, what happened? Why was David more affected? Because this was an act of Nevuah. There was prophecy going on here. And this reminds you of the story when Yaakov meets Yosef and they fall on each other's necks. And Rashi says, what was going on over there? Very interestingly, that there was a prophecy there of the fact that the temple was one day going to be destroyed. That was one of the things that was going on there.
Sorry? I think
Joseph and Benjamin. Oh, yes. Correct. Yes, and Binyamin. But with Yaakov is slightly different. Yaakov, he was saying Krishma, right? Yaakov was saying Kriyat Shema, and that was something else. Correct. Yosef and Binyamin, and again, you know, when these people are even in their sort of way that they greet each other, they hug each other, or they kiss each other, whatever it may be, there is such a depth, there is such a spirituality to what they're doing. It is quite unreal. And of course, at this point, just see what happened. Just one point, that Higdil, why was David more affected than Yonatan? Because he saw that Yonatan was going to be killed in battle. We have this unbelievable end of Shmuel Aleph, when Shaul goes in the most noble way possible to the war with the Plishtim. He knows that this is it. He's told by the Witch of Endor, which is a whole story, please God, will learn in not too distant future, and it's a whole unbelievable story in its own right. And we'll get to some sort of awareness that Yonatan knew, together with his father and the other brothers, that this was it. They are going to lead the Jewish people in a battle which they weren't going to win, and they were going to be killed. And nevertheless they go, and David already sees this, and this is why he's just distraught. He knows that Yonatan is going to eventually die in battle, and David will outlive him. And again, it's just so sad, and look what he says at the end. Vayomi Yonatan le David, posuk mem bet, verse 42, lech l'shalom, go in peace. Yonatan says to David, go, you know, look after yourself, as it were. Asher nishbanu shelenu, excuse me, that we have sworn between us, anachlo b'shem Hashem leimo, in the name of God, saying, Hashem yeh b'ni u'b'necha, God will be between me and you, b'n zari u'b'n zarech ad olam, between our children forever. And really, and the only other time we see that David and Jonathan really come together, and I suppose you would say chapa conversation, but it's really very, very difficult because David is running the whole time, is later on in chapter 23. If you just see very briefly, in chapter 23, right in the middle, Perek Chof Gimel, chapter 23, verse 16. Where does it start off there? It's page 110. In verse 16, it just says, Vayokam Yonasan ben Shaul, Vayelech el David Chorsha. This is when David is running for his life to all different places around the Negev, around the south. And they get to a place called Chorsha, and Yonatan runs to him, Vayechazek et yado b'elohim, and he strengthens his hand through God. Basically, in other words, you know, he goes to sort of be with him, hopefully at that point, to as it says here, as Rashi says, to renew the covenant. They made this covenant, which we just read about, and Yonatan wants to renew it, and Yonatan wants to strengthen it. But Yomer Elov, and this is all they say to each other, and he says to him, Al tira, do not be afraid. Ki lo timtsacha yad Sha'ol avi, Sha'ol will never find you. Ve'ata timlocha Yisrael, you'll be the king. Va'anochi echa l'mishna, and I'll be your second in command. Alright, Yonatan is unbelievable. He's prepared to take on to be the second in command, and he knows this. But Gam Shalavi Yodekain, and he says, "My father Shaul knows this as well."
Did Yonatan
ever become the Mishnah? No, never, because he died in battle. He's saying it, but we'll have to understand this. I'll just tell you something. What Rav Bachra says, it blows the mind. I'll tell you in a second. But just look at the pasuk Yudchet VaYichretu Shneim Brit Lifnei Hashem. They make this covenant again. VaYeshedoi B'Chorsha VaYonatan Alach LeBeito. Yonatan goes home. And from what I understand, unless you can find another connection later on, I think that's the last time they talk to each other. It's really sad. Rav Bachra says something here which really just blew me away. He says like this, as we said, that when David went to the front line, Perich Yudchet, and remember we spoke about that he brings this kind of guarantee. The guarantee of looking after Shaul, looking after the interests of Shaul. And we explained that this is Yehuda looking after Binyamin. Going right back into sort of biblical history, the whole idea of Yehuda, who stood up to his father and said, I will guarantee that Binyamin will come back from Mitzrayim. That was a guarantee, not just for Binyamin in the immediate situation, but for the future. And Rav Bachra wants to say something. He says something here which just is precious. He says that let's go back, he says, to the story of Rachel and Leah. He says, what happened? He says, the two sisters, and of course we know that Yaakov really was absolutely, I suppose whatever word we're going to use, besotted, if that's the right word, with Rachel. We know that. And whether one understands it in a sort of physical sense, spiritual sense, all different senses, you want to understand it. And we know that at the point when Rachel talks to Leah, we know that certainly Midrashically they have a conversation about this. And Leah is distraught. Leah is totally distraught because what does she say? She says quite simply, you know, if you marry Jacob, then who am I going to marry? Esav, that's the other brother. I'm destined to marry Esav. And she already heard about his reputation. This is not a man that you really want to marry, not a man you really want to have anything to do with. And she cried and cried, and we know that this was one of the things that Rachel and Leah were very, very connected by. And it's so interesting because remember what happened, that we know the story that Leah switched with Rachel, and it says Rachel had some sort of simanim, whatever that was, some sort of sign to show that it was her who was marrying Yaakov, and of course she gave the simanim to Leah. Okay, remember this story, and as a result, Yaakov marries Leah instead of Rachel. And from that point on, of course, you think about it, Rachel was making the ultimate sacrifice, because if Leah is going to marry Yaakov, then it could very well be that she'll end up with Esau. All right? In other words, she's prepared to give up her situation. Rachel is prepared to give it up in order to comfort her sister Leah to marry the person they want to marry, both of them essentially, to marry Yaakov, and even to the point where it may affect her future in this terrible way.
Don't they say that the reason they were simanim is because they look identical?
That could be in terms of look. I've never read that, but that's possible. That's possible. But again, you know, the simanim, one assumes that obviously the whole idea, because it was a night time and there were no lights, and you know, some sort of word, a siman, you know, in the Torah, it's used later on with the going out of Egypt. Pakod pakadati, right? That's a siman. That's an expression which when Am Yisrael, hear it again from Moshe Rabbeinu, then they know this is from the promise of Yosef that they're going to come out of Israel. You know, that's what I guess what the simanim is. It's some sort of password, right? What they call in Hebrew, what is it? Sisma, right? You know, in the army, sisma. Okay, I forgot what my sisma is. My unit has a sisma, right? I can't remember. It's one of the, you know, actually, Gan Yarok or something. I don't know what it was. You know, as soon as you hit out the radio, you run straight to Miluim. That's the way they do it in Israel. I suppose they still do it like that, I guess. Yeah, you get your unit sends out a message, they send out a password, and the next thing you know, you've got to go into the army. That's usually a bad situation. You don't really want to hear that very often. The whole thing there, though, I just want to say one thing like this, because it's so precious what he says. He says that as a result, Rachel shows a tremendous sense of caring for Leah. And this is something which really doesn't go away. And Rav Bachar wants to suggest that this becomes a historical connection between these two people, between these two lines of Am Yisrael. You're going to have who is represented by Rachel later on, essentially Shaul and Yonatan, the tribes of Binyamin that descend, Yosef and Binyamin that descend from Rachel. So here you've got Yonatan, who is now, as it were, showing tremendous ahava, love towards David, over and above something that we can really just, we can't come to terms really with the way that he feels towards David, everything about it. And the suggestion Rav Bachar wants to say is that this, again, takes on a historical perspective. What you have originally is this incredible connection that Rachel puts herself in such a difficult position in order to protect Leah. And as a result, of course, who's represented by Leah? The tribe of Yehuda, one of her sons, which obviously becomes David. And at this point in time, Yonatan is fulfilling that amazing connection that existed historically between Rachel and Leah is now being fulfilled by Yonatan towards David. Yonatan represents Rachel and David represents Leah. It's just an unbelievable thought. And as such, then you understand not only why there is a close relationship, but the word ahava, this is extreme. And it's a word that we've used, nafsho kashurah b'nafsho. They have this bond in their soul, not just in the way that they conduct their friendship with each other, but their soulmates. And this is something which, again, historically, the suggestion Bachrach makes is that it goes right back into the history of the avot and essentially the imahot. As I said before, that the mothers also become siman lebanim, that the way that Rachel looks after Leah is so precious that it becomes a standard which later on reflects itself in Yonatan's behavior towards David. And it's a way of thinking about it which really just is remarkable. All the way through we see this continuum. And of course, take it stage further down the line, as we've mentioned before, and what do you get with Purim, which is coming up, please God, very soon, you get Mordechai. So what is Mordechai? On the one hand, he's Ish Yemini, so he's Binyamin, so he represents Rachel. And on the other hand, he's Mordechai Yehudi. Everybody calls him Yehudi, Yehuda. And we know that, in fact, from one side of the family it was Yehuda, the other side it was Binyamin. So Mordechai represents this kind of shiluv, this joining between these two incredible streams, these two lines of influence, the influence of Rachel and the influence of Leah, and it becomes so powerful. And to me, it's just, Bachar doesn't say this, but I think it's like an obvious extension. Why is Am Yisrael so successful is because there's an achdus in Mordechai. Mordechai represents this unity that Am Yisrael can achieve when you get the line of Yehuda joining together with the line of Binyamin. And it's an incredible thing. And we mentioned already before that, of course, the Beit HaMikdash, which should, and hopefully does, represent the unity of the Jewish people. What is it made up of? The territory of Yehuda, and a bit of the territory of Binyamin. Again, coming together to make an entity, a strength, which is something which we understand, that when Am Yisrael is be'achdut, is unified, then anything can happen, anything can be achieved. It just is a theme which just runs through history, and of course the tragedy of what we're going to read, when we get to Malachim Aleph and the split of the kingdom, is the reality that Yosef goes off and Binyamin, well, Yosef essentially, not Binyamin, but Yosef goes off in one direction, and in the south, of course, we've got Yehuda represented with the kings after Shlomo, go off in the other direction. And that's when Am Yisrael gets into terrible, terrible trouble. And it's something to think about today, you know, sort of we hopefully can bring sort of these streams together, because nowadays, you know, we're not sort of so tribal as we used to be. Hopefully we can bring it all back. And Kibbutz Goliot is the whole concept of uniting, having all those strands of history that existed for such a long time, sometimes together, most of the time separate, and we're bringing it all back together again. Kibbutz Goliot as a preparation, as a messianic preparation for the building of the third temple. It just blows the mind. And again, this is the theme of Purim. This is one of the issues why Purim is such a special day, because it represents a time when there was unity. And of course, the problem is, and I hate to say this, but what happens at the end of the Megillah? The end of the Megillah, what does it say about Mordechai? You've laid it, right? Ratzui? Robocop, right? And he's only acceptable after saving the skins of everybody. He becomes acceptable only to the majority. Now that is so sad. So even for a short period of time, you know, I think back to 67 and everything that was going on and the unity of Am Yisrael and the tremendous sense of Achdus. And we had a bit of this a few weeks ago, you know, with Gaza. We had the feeling that everybody all of a sudden is on the same page. We're all understanding the danger. And that, again, went off the boil. It's gone off the boil already, and now we're worried again about the whole situation. The political situation has gone completely crazy again, and you know, and we're back to rockets, and we're back to square one almost, and it's kind of scary. And again, when we feel that there's a unity, where there's an achdus, where there's something coming together, wow, you can't stop it. It's a machine which is really very, very strong. But that achdus sometimes just is a fleeting moment sometimes, or maybe a few days or a few weeks or something. And again, one of the things to think about for Purim is that should be a day, really a focus, hopefully, of Achdus all over again. That's just the pitch. I don't quite know what one does about that, but certainly we all should celebrate together in that vein. I think that's something to think about. Alright, so that's essentially chapter 21. And as you'll see, look at Chaf Aleph, which is the beginning of the next chapter. Vayokom Vayelech. So David goes in one direction, Vayonatan Bahair, and Yonatan goes back to the city, and that's it. They part ways. What we have to deal with, and again, as I said, I'm going to start this today, but I'm not going to be able to finish it as such, is to discuss a bit about Shaul. In the end of the day, we've now sort of, I hope, come to a great awareness a bit about David. As we go along, we'll learn more and more about King David. Some of the positive things and some of the challenging things, let's put it that way. But of course, what we haven't really dealt with, we've dealt with the son of, we've dealt with Yonatan, but we haven't dealt with the issue of Shaul. What is really going on in the mind of Shaul? We see here, he loses it, he picks up his spear, he's almost going to kill, not only tries to kill David, whether it's daydreaming or not daydreaming, as we spoke about before, but the reality is, you know, what's going on with this guy? What is happening with Shaul in his mind that he now gets to the point where he becomes so potentially violent, so potentially dangerous? What is going on? And of course, the simple answer, which I think the world seems to be comfortable with, is that basically he's gone a bit gaga, he's gone nuts. All right, everybody sort of talks about the madness of King Saul. Talk about the madness of George III. I think that's another king that they relate to. The madness of King Lear and all the various other characters that one can think of, real or otherwise. And, you know, Shaul HaMelech becomes one of those characters that you put on the list. And the problem with that is that it doesn't work. It doesn't work to say that Shaul is crazy. And the basic reason for that, and again, we're going to discuss this, is that you read the next couple of parochim, and you'll see that there are thousands of people following Shaul. If Shaul was nuts, then people would start, you know, not following him. He wouldn't have such a... He's got 3,000 men running around with him, chasing after David, and going to Nov Ira Kohanim, and that whole terrible story we're going to read in the next couple of weeks, which is the continuation over here. But the reality is, Shaul has a following. If he's got a following, then for goodness sake, you know, to say that he's crazy, and to say that he's lost his bearings and everything else, doesn't make sense with all these people supporting him at the same time. As soon as people begin to feel that this guy is losing reality, then my guess is they would clearly back off. They wouldn't give him the support. And yet, here we are, and we're seeing that Shaul is supported. So the suggestion that Shaul is going nuts at this point, has gone crazy, doesn't work. And I just want to show you this, because this is again a very interesting piece, kind of a piece de resistance of Bachrach, because it's very, very important to understand. It's like the final piece of the jigsaw here. We've sort of dealt with David, we've dealt with Yonatan, but we still have to deal with Shaul. I'm sorry it's a bit small, I had to actually reduce it very, very slightly just to get it on the page. And the question of the change of Shaul's character, what we're dealing with is the very basic question, what is going on with Shaul? As I said at the top here, how could he change so dramatically? Is he a true Rodef? Is he really chasing David to the point where we can argue that he's doing it out of personal jealousy and personal resentment, and you name a million and one different reasons, what is going on? And the quote to remember is a quote from Shir HaShirim Rabbah, the top of the right-hand column, and this is unbelievable. It says, Kasher kishaol kina. Now, the Pasuk actually says that kina, jealousy, is kasher, is difficult, is as hard, Kishol, like death, I suppose you would say, translate it. All right, but obviously the word Sha'ol can also be read Sha'ul. All right, and of course here we're going to play on the word and begin to understand from this quotation a very, very amazing insight. And the Midrash says there, Kina Shekinei Sha'ul B'David. It says, it points out that the Pasuk, when it talks about Kina, jealousy, and it says it's kasher kisha'ol, it's like it's as difficult as death, it's actually kisha'ol, it's as difficult as what Sha'ul does in terms of the jealousy that he exhibits towards David. So clearly the rabbis of the Midrash see in Sha'ul a case of kina. It's not a case of madness. Jealousy is not madness. All right, you can be perfectly sane and jealous at the same time. You don't have to be crazy to be jealous. And this is something which we have to come to terms with. What are we talking about when we talk about jealousy? What sort of jealousy are we referring to here? And this is going to be a revelation which is it's just precious. It's beyond belief. I'm now tempted, because I've got a few minutes, maybe I'll just be mekatzer, because this will be a nice thing to take away. It's really so special. We're going to obviously not go through the whole text, but I'll just show you the breakdown here. And some of the questions, let's just deal with that for the moment. So this is the basic question. Sha'ul's a good man. This is not a bad person. This is a tzaddik. Sha'ul is a righteous individual. How could he become somebody who chases and he's taking revenge and he harbors resentment? What's going on here? How could Sha'ul change like that? And that's question number one. Hu asher b'techila. This is somebody that we know from the beginning. Barach min asrara. He runs away from being the king. He's very modest. He hides, remember, amongst all the different baggage or whatever. Mitbayesh mipniyan, he's very embarrassed, he doesn't want to be the king. And what happens now? Now it says, Atahu matchil lirdof acharel. Now he seems to have the sense he's chasing after kingship, essentially. Bechama shvucha gluya lako, with tremendous anger. What is going on with Sha'ul? That is the problem. And of course, the second question here, ha'im mutar lanu linkot b'deya, can we really follow the opinion? Ki Sha'ul b'otot kufa yachol nefesh. Sha'ul is considered to be mentally sick. When it says he had a bad spirit from God, does that mean he was mentally ill? Is this something which adds to his punishment, that he becomes mentally imbalanced? Is that really the whole interpretation? It's very cruel on him to have this. You know, we know that he sinned, that he messed up with Amalek. We're going to read the story next Shabbat for the Haftarah. At the end of the day, he is punished. He loses the kingship. So why bring mental illness upon him as a punishment when he's getting punished anyway? It's unfair. It seems to be extreme. And this is, again, a question we can ask. Why then remove his knowledge, his understanding, his sense? Va'bechira, and his choice, the tordo l'matzav tragi kazen, put him into such a tragic situation. V'chininalu b'fnei Sha'ul sha'rei tshuva. And in the end of the day, is Sha'ul incapable or denied the ability to do teshuva? Is this really what we're saying? I mean, it doesn't make sense. And it says that also would be very, very terrible. And look at number six. V'lama haya od sarech lezamnan yachad. Again, in other words, if we're talking about a situation where Sha'ul is in this situation of craziness, then why put David in harm's way to be near to Sha'ul? Doesn't make sense. The whole relationship doesn't make sense. And again, at the end, he also says, of course, the question number eight, what did David do wrong in order that he has to run away? What's his sin? Of course, we spoke about that. It wasn't a sin, but it was something else in terms of preparing Galut for Am Yisrael. But that's a different thing.
He's stressing that why does Sha'ul have to see David's ascension?
It's so cruel. It's a terrible cruelty. It's really slapping him in the face. And he doesn't deserve it. He's a good man. Sha'ul is a very good man. He made a mistake. Who doesn't make mistakes in life? We all make mistakes in life. And yet here he is, and he's given this terrible, terrible deal. So what Bachrach does, he runs initially, the first section over here, which runs to the middle of the second column, is discussing the whole question of his mental illness, if you believe he was mentally ill. And he argues just look at the top of the next column. Halo l'divrehem yesh litmar. If you claim that he's ill, there's a problem. Shenatayim u'mechsa hosif sha'olim locha Yisrael. He remains the king for 2.5 years after this story. Ve'ish mikol ha'am lo egish ve'lo yada ki malkam chala nafsho. And nobody seems to claim, well, you know, the king is mentally ill, he's sick. Nobody says a word. Ve'chol ha'am hosifu lo leched acharav. And people follow him. Lilchom milchamotav, they fight the wars with him. Bashe erkam kimalkam chalan. Lost the line here. Bashe erkam ba'emek ha'ela. Right, when it says over there that they have a whole battle emek ha'ela, which is obvious, that's the story with Goliath. Be'ki'ilah, in a place called Ki'ilah, b'chronah, b'shunam, and later on, right at the end of the Sefer, in a place called Shunah. Why do they follow him? And if he's crazy, then they won't follow him. Now, Rav, Saritzva'o, Vavadav, Hayuimo, Ba'itza, everybody seems to be with him on the same page. Masu'a Devaro. Gam Yashua Sarim Ashulchanah, the people, his princes sit with him. Bimeh Chodesh, Kapam, Bapam. As we just read, that nobody backing off and saying, oh, the king's nuts, don't go to sit with him. So the suggestion, says Baruch, is that to say he's crazy doesn't fit into the evidence of the Sefer. So he says, look, I'm going to suggest something else. We're going to use a concept, he says, which is found in Greek writing, is the concept of tragic figure. Those who read Macbeth or you read Shakespeare, any sort of Shakespeare, Hamlet, there is this concept that certainly from Greek writing that, you know, somebody's life just takes a tragic turn for the worse. You just become, a victim of your circumstance, right? Macbeth, he's told this prophecy and he has to go and kill everybody around him. You know, he feels that he has to murder them because the witches told him what's going to be. Even though the conflict between what he feels is right and what he feels is wrong is so strong, and of course that's Shakespeare's whole brilliance in what he's putting into that character. The reality is, he becomes a tragic figure. He's doing things that he doesn't want to do. And says Rav Bachra, very nice for Greek mythology, he says, but it doesn't work in the Bible. The Bible is not a book of Greek concepts of tragedy and fate. Right? Fate is something that Judaism doesn't really believe in. We don't believe in the fates, in the gods with a small g. We believe in Yad Hashem. So basically, without going into the whole explanation over here, and I'm being makatzer, but I really want to get to this point. We're going to, if you just turn over, you'll see the third option. And I'm letting you, maybe you want to take this away, you can have a look at this, because it's so beautiful what he says. He says, you know what I'm going to say? I'm going to go back to the phrase we learned at the beginning. Kasher kisha'ol kina. He says, you know what happened here? And let me explain this, because I think this is fabulous. He says that what happened to Shaul is something which is so traumatic, but we can understand it. Try and understand it. He says, Shaul, we know he became the king, and he became imbued with a spirit of Hashem. He says, you can't understand what that means. It just is something which is so difficult to explain. I can only say it's the feeling that you might have. If you think back, you know, when your first child is born, when you're supposed to feel under the chuppah, when I look under the chuppah sometimes, you know, some of the chosen and kala, the way they look, you know, looks as if they're going to execution there. I mean, it's terrible. And you're supposed to feel happy, it's supposed to be a happy day. And it worries me when they're looking as if, you know, this is the end. Whatever, maybe that's not a good example. What you feel at a moment when you got that result, that you passed the exam, that you were hoping to pass, there's an elevation of spirit. It's something that happens to a person. It doesn't happen very often in your life, but it can happen when you win something or when you achieve something. And Shaul achieved it when he became the king. He was given this Ruach Hashem. We can't understand what it is. We don't know what it is, but it elevated him. Agam Shaul Banaviim. We saw that phrase, that he is now counted as one of the prophets. And we know that as soon as he failed, we're going to read this again, this Shabbat, in the story with Amalek, he lost it. That sense of elevation, that sense of holiness, that sense of connection went away. And the trouble is, where did it go? It went to David. And Shaul knows this. He knows that David now has this, for want of a better word, he looks the part. He radiates. The Gemara says David was eventually, you couldn't look at him. He had this kedusha, this holiness radiating from him. It was like trying to look at the sun, the Gemara says. You couldn't look at David. And that is something which Shaul understands has transferred from him to David. And this is something which is eating him up. Shaul, for all of his crazy behavior over here, has a very, very good excuse to say that I know that, you know, in the end of the day, I had something precious, and I know that I blew it. I know that I should have done what I did, and I didn't own up, and I didn't do what I was supposed to do, and I didn't make the right noises at the right time, as we're going to read. But the reality is, look what happened. You know, to lose this precious gift, it's something which is so mind-blowing for him, he can't come to terms with it. And every time he thinks about it, excuse me, every time he gets some sort of sense of regret, then he goes into depression. And what we're seeing here is a classic example of someone who knows what he could be, he knows his potential, he knows what he had. He had it in his hand, he had the trophy in his hand, he had the Kedusha, he had the spirit of Hashem, and he lost it. And that was something he couldn't come to terms with. And every time he thinks about it, he goes into this depression. And of course, as soon as David interacts with him, David, or anything to do with David, Yonatan's attempt to try and make peace, and of course that immediately brings back the same feelings, kinah. All of a sudden, Shaul has got kinah. But this is kinah of an incredible spiritual nature. I just want to read one piece with you, just in the last page, the last paragraph over here, at the bottom. It's just unreal what happens over here. It's the middle of the last paragraph on the fourth column, as it were. Ketzad, it's underlined. Ketzad afacha isha tov azel rodev. What we're going to say, that how did Shaul become this rodev, someone who starts chasing after David. And you just go down three lines. Tamimim shebechem yomru, heyod Shaul anav v'tzanu. You'll say, you know what, Shaul was very modest. Berech min asrara b'tchila, and he certainly did not want to become king at the beginning. Hare tov hu oseh ba'otoshai, he did good at one time. Ilo ha yemeisir alav b'gdei malchuto, and it would have been better for him to take off his crown now. Ve'et kidro b'niach oto lifnei anavi, give it to Shmuel. V'ulai gam modelo anetilat srara zu mimenu. And he'll just agree, you know, David is the new king, I'm giving up, I'm finished. But he says no. If you just go down, you'll see over here a quote from the Midrash. He says, once you've tasted leadership, once you're in a position where you're running the show, when you are the spiritual focus of Am Yisrael, you can't give it up. And when Shaul was faced with this situation where he had to give it up, because it was taken away from him, the sense of holiness that he felt, he knew it. He knew what that high was. And he now could not achieve it anymore. He became depressed. So what we're talking about, and this is such an insight, it's so powerful. It's saying that Shaul is become a rodev, not out of malice. This is not something which we're saying that he's doing it because he's an evil person. He's just suffering from this terrible sense of kinah. He knows what David has. He knows that he used to have it himself. And he now can't come to terms with the fact that he can only blame himself for what he lost, what he had, and what he no longer has. And this is such an insight because it puts Shaul back into the real world. Shaul is not crazy. Shaul is not a tragic figure. We always use the word tragedy with Shaul, and I've got to be careful every time I say that, because I'm going to be saying it a number of times, I'm sure. It's the word that we always use. But not in the traditional sense of a tragic figure. This is a man who had such a potential. And I suppose the way we can sum up Shaul, his kind of epitaph, is to say he had the potential and he lost it. And this is so sad, but at the same time, we understand what now he's going through, why he can come to these terrible depressions. And yet, you'll see when we get to the point in Ein Gedi, in chapter 24, when they meet up again. And one more time later on, when Shaul sort of moves away from the depression, and he sees David and realizes that David is the right person to continue, then all of a sudden, it's Shaul, he says to David, Bani, Bani, he becomes his son, he becomes close, he mellows all over again. Shaul is without doubt one of the real sad and again, on the one hand, significant, but on the other hand, so sad. The moral is, you know, when you have the potential, live up to the potential, grab the moment, carpe diem, you know, really go for it. And once you've got it, you know, try and hold on to what you have in terms of the achievement. If it's difficult to hold on, try and do the best you can and not fall into the trap that Shaul falls into, which is so difficult when he knows that he lost something so precious and can never achieve it again. It's very difficult. You know, I was thinking this evening about sort of a comparison. You know, if you went to study in yeshiva and you manage to learn so much Torah, and you know, after you go into the real world, as it were, and then all of a sudden you become compromised, you haven't got time to learn because you're too busy working or too busy making money or whatever, you know, one has to sort of come to terms with that. For a lot of people, it's very difficult. They want to stay in yeshiva for a long time, and I think it just this is a kind of metaphor for this. And the reality is that, you know, don't make the mistake of Shaul to think that, you know, once you've lost it, you can never achieve it back again. And in this case, Shaul was almost denied that access, but in terms of learning, so you won't be learning 12 hours a day. You'll be learning maybe an hour a day. But you know, you put into that hour, you put into that few minutes, whatever it is, that becomes your commitment. It's not about the amount that you learn, but it's about the kviut, the fact that you fix the time to learn. You know, that Monday night you'll come and learn, and that becomes a fixed time, and that's a very precious thing. And that's what you get asked after 120 years. It's not how much you learn; it's did you fix the time to learn? It could be a few minutes when you sit on the train, when you do something, you know, whatever it is, just to keep that sense of learning alive, that's to keep that sense of connection. And this is what I get out of this, that Shaul lost that connection, he lost that spirituality, and of course, this is why it starts off. We read, Kasher Kishaol Kina, Kina Shekine Shaul B'David. He was really, truly jealous. It's sad. It's a really sad thing. And as we see in the next couple of chapters, it gets to a hiatus, certainly with the story of Nob, Mitzvah Shem, in 2 weeks' time.
Doesn't it also show a frailty?
Yeah.
Because throughout Jewish history, we know tzaddikim are punished for minor infractions,
yeah,
much greater than we would think.
Yeah.
Just think of Moshe. Moshe, even though he was punished,
yeah,
he couldn't go into Eretz Israel, he never went into the state of depression that
Shaul goes into.
Right?
Yeah, and that was Shaul's character. Yeah,
that he lets the melancholy
takes over. Yeah, yeah. But what I want you to understand is, it's not melancholy out of madness or melancholy out of fate. It's out of depression, and that's what's going on here.
Depression takes him.
And takes hold of him, but he's not a bad person. He comes over as being so aggressive, but it's not. It's the other show. You know, it's almost as if he becomes schizophrenic. Sorry?
There's nothing to take away from his tzidkis.
Correct.
You know, he's inside.
Correct.
But he's a frail person in the sense that he allows the depression to take
over. Correct. Correct.
And
it happens a lot. And you know, all I want to say is, this is one of the great examples. I spoke about it a few months ago, that when we deal with Jewish heroes, we also deal with real people. You know, there's only one person in the world who's infallible, and thank God he's not Jewish. You know, that's the issue. The issue is here that we're dealing with a great man, but he's very fallible. And his fallibility, in the end, proves to be his downfall. But what a tzaddik, what an incredible person. Shaul is the person, you know, every time I teach this, I go into tears at the end. Especially when you read chapter 31 and you read about that, you cry because this is a very special person. He got such a raw deal. He got a really rough deal. And you cry for him because you know that this is a good person. Underneath it, he's a tzaddik. He really wants the best, not only for Klal Yisrael, for the people around him, for everybody around him, even for David. That's what I really believe. He really wants the best for David, but he can't overcome that sense of loss. Please take this away if you can. Work your way through this. It's so precious what he says. Bezrat Hashem, to be continued. Have a very happy and joyous Freilichim Purim, and please God, we'll see you on the 23rd. Thank you.